This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. The last 2 weeks on Cadenza, we've chatted with young American cellists. 2 weeks ago, Laura Medcalf with her guitarist husband, Rupert Boyd. And last week, Mario Roberts, who is expanding the repertoire and sound world of this great string instrument through performance and commissioning of new music for cello. This week, we'll chat with another young American cellist and no less a trailblazer than my guest last week. We'll speak with Juliana Soltis, who is doing some trailblazing in the area of the cello, but at the other end of the historical spectrum for this instrument. She herself hails from the Appalachia region on the east side of the Mississippi. After training as a classical cellist at the New England and Oberlin Conservatories, she decided to take up and devote her time to the Baroque cello, essentially the same instrument we know as the cello today, but with some eye-popping important structural and performance differences. She also went west to settle in Seattle and participate in the vibrant early music scene in that city. She has performed all over the globe, even performing the Bach solo cello suites in Japan. Her debut recording is just out on the Assis label, a boutique label with a roster that boasts both emerging and Grammy-nominated classical artists and specializes in early music, vocal, and keyboard. My guest's debut CD on this label is called Entre le Diable, Enter the Devil, the virtuoso cello at the Concert Spirituel. It focuses on the cello coming to 18th century France, Paris. Though the cello was established in other parts of Europe, France had held tightly to its long-reigning and highly esteemed love affair with the viola da gamba. And through my guest's research and performances, she'll take us back to a recital given in 1736 by the Italian cello virtuoso Salvatore Lanzetti that changed the course of the cello in France and then by extension Europe. The composers like Lanzetti on this disc are not well known, hence the trailblazing research by my guest. You're listening to the first movement of the cello Sonata in E minor, Opus 1, number 8, from this CD by Lanzetti. In fact, all the music you'll hear on this program is from that disc, and my guest, Juliana Soltis, is accompanied throughout the recording by Adiah McAdam Sommer on viola da gamba, Lucas Harris on tiarbo, and Justin Murphy Mancini on harpsichord. I spoke with Juliana Soltis by phone last week. Thank you. very happy today to be speaking with cellist Juliana Soltis. This is a rather fortuitous that I'm getting to talk with you at this time, because my cadenza program last week was another young cellist by the name of Mariel Roberts. Now, Mariel focuses on expanding the cello repertoire and sort of the sound world and discovering new things for the cello from now into the future. So she's commissioning new works and expanding the sound world. You, however, are sort of taking the cello back to the other direction of discovery and sound worlds and all that. It's going to be a fascinating interview. I think we get both ends of sort of the history of the cello here by speaking with you today. So I'm glad we hooked up at this time. It's going to work out great.
Well, wonderful. I'm very happy to be on the show.
Just a little bit about you. You grew up here in the East, sort of Appalachia. How, whether it was through your family or teacher, how did you settle on the cello with all the other various string instruments? And how did the cello fall into your hands?
Oh my gosh. I started playing the cello because there was a free program available in the public schools where I grew up. And it's a program that continues to this day, which is wonderful. It's a partnership between the West Virginia Symphony and Kanawha County Schools. And it offers free lessons to basically any kid starting in the fourth grade who wants to play an instrument. And a string quartet came to our school, and we're all sitting there in the, it's a really small school, we're sitting there in the cafeteria / gymnasium.
Right.
And they had those retro Christmas tree lights. Remember those big incandescent lights that you used to put on a Christmas tree?
Yeah.
I got burned on them, I think, a couple times when I was little. But they had them attached to their stands, and they had little foot pedals. And they played Beethoven. What I later found out was Beethoven, Opus 18, number 1. And every time they had that bum, 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 bum theme, they would step on their little pedal and the light would come on. And to a 9-year-old, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Did you focus it on the cello? Was that sort of drew you to that out of the three instruments? I mean, no kid would hone in on the viola probably, but still, you know.
Oh, my sister would be so sad to hear you say
sorry,
that.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, it did. I often feel a little disappointed in myself that I don't have a super cosmic story about how it was that I picked the cello, that there was this magic moment where it's like, oh, this is going to be the rest of my life at age 9. But I went home at the end of the day, and I had the little permission slip, and my mom says, okay, you can play an instrument if you want to. And I was like, all right, I'm going to play the cello. Of course, my mother's face blanches a little bit because I was very tiny, and I think she sensed she was going to be carrying it for me for the next couple of years, which she did. Thank
you,
Mommy.
Yeah, sure.
And it just started sort of as simply and as beautifully as that.
So you go on, you study New England Conservatory, Oberlin among the schools, and you study classical cello. How did the Baroque cello first come across your path? Was it the music? Was it the instrument? Was there a mentor? I mean, how did you come to that? And then as you started to discover the early music for cello and the earlier instrument, decide that you could probably make this a career, if you get my gist,
Sure. It was one of those things, I think, kind of like, falling in love with a particular person, that it happened very gradually, and it took me a while to really see what was going on, because I had always loved Baroque music. I loved Bach and Vivaldi when I was younger, and like many young players, I got really into romantic music when I was in high school. You've got all these emotions, that you're trying to express as a teenager, and then got very into contemporary music when I was at NEC. But through it all, I really did have a particular passion for Baroque music that stuck with me as sort of an undercurrent, and it had never really occurred to me that it was something that I could do all the time. And I went to the TOEFL Music Baroque Orchestra in Toronto. Has a really wonderful summer program, the TOEFL Music Baroque Summer Institute. And while I was working on my first master's degree, I went there kind of on a whim. I had had a bad year, and I thought, this sounds like fun. I want to do this instead of, going to Aspen or Tanglewood. And got there, and it was my first experience with actually playing this music that I loved in a historical style. And it was like something just finally sparked in my brain that, like, oh, well, this is exciting, and this is interesting, and I want to know more about this, and I want to do more of this. And from there, it wasn't even so much that I saw that I could make a career out of it, as I just decided that's what I was going to do.
I mean, there were early cellists. I mean, there have always been people who've played viola da gamba, but Baroque cellists, you know, go back a few decades as far as they've made names for themselves, they've made careers, they make recordings, they front groups. And I guess there was just, by the time you had seen this, fallen in love with it and got the experience to play this earlier instrument, there was the sense that there was something there to follow. There was something to follow up on and be successful at it, correct? I mean, by the time you were doing this. I mean, you'd seen it with Tafel music.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really wonderful, you know, to be able to build on all of the work that has been done in, say, the past 3 or 4 decades. There are so many wonderful performers to look to for inspiration or who are, you know, still with us and you can ask for guidance. I read a really interesting editorial. I have it pinned up on my refrigerator in Seattle. It's written by Thomas Kelly, and it says, "Trailblazers Wanted." And I saved it because I found it really struck a chord with me. He's talking about the difference between, you know, sort of some of the earlier pioneers of historical performance and performers today, and how we're bridging a gap between the two, because it used to be that there weren't necessarily teachers that you could go to. Say, I want to learn to play Baroque violin.
Right.
You got the copy of the Mozart treatise, and you know, got some gut strings and a different bow, and you sort of figured it out yourself. And now there are programs that you can enroll in. I myself am a graduate of 2. And he was a little concerned that there was something that was lacking in my generation of performers, that spirit of exploration. And I saved this because the idea of exploration and of uncovering works that maybe have been sitting dusty on a shelf for so long and experimenting with the techniques in these treatises to see what kind of sounds do they produce, that's what excites me the most about early music.
So before you take us back to 1736 in France, one more thing about you. You mentioned the city. I mean, you're from the east side of the country. You have performed all over the globe. Why did you settle in Seattle? I was curious.
I moved to Seattle almost 3 years ago in December of 2014, and it was about 6 months after I finished my second master's at Oberlin. And to be honest, one of the reasons that I moved was because my grandmother had passed away right before I graduated, and we were incredibly close. And it was one of those moments, I'm sure a lot of people have felt this way, that something happens in your life and you just very suddenly have this impulse that you want to physically be as far away as you can possibly be. And so that was the original motivation for going west. I thought, well, I've never lived on the West Coast before. Let's give this a shot. And Seattle is a city that musically just has so many interesting things going on. Obviously, for me as a child of the 90s, you know, grunge was huge
right.
For me. But, you know, the Seattle Symphony is a wonderful orchestra, Seattle Opera. Stephen Stubbs, who most people know from the Boston Early Music Festival, runs his own group out there, Pacific Music Works. Seattle Baroque Orchestra, there are groups in Vancouver. And so I was really intrigued by the musical activities.
Seattle is a very vibrant early music culture. I remember Seattle Baroque was Byron Shankman and Ingrid Matthews used to be out there. I don't know if they still are, but you know, there's
they
a very
are.
Vibrant, yeah, very vibrant scene happening out there. Again, for my guest, cellist Juliana Soltis' debut CD on the Assis label, Entre le Diable, the virtuoso cello at the Concert Spirituel, here is the middle movement, Aria Gratioso, from one François Martin's cello sonata in D major, opus 2, number 4. Thank you. So this debut disc of yours on the Asus label, this Entre le Diable, Enter the Devil, you're going to take us in this disc back to mid-1730s France. But I want you to lead up to that with the cello, because the cello as we know it, it didn't look the same and it sounded a little bit different, but what would become our modern cello, had already been around for a while. And I guess one of its main centers was Italy. I wonder if you could give our listeners a little bit of background leading up to where this CD takes place. Also, the relation of what we know as the cello to the viola da gamba. So maybe start with those two areas and sort of lead us into where this CD takes place.
I think that most people, when they think of the cello, have something very specific in mind, and that's either an instrument that they've heard on recordings or that they have seen live in performance, either with an orchestra or a string quartet. But I think what many people don't realize, and what's very exciting to me as a performer, is that the cello as we know it now is not the cello as it always has been. You go 200 or more years back, and the cello is not completely unrecognizable, but certainly quite different than the instrument we have today. There are some cosmetic differences, of course. The first one that most people notice is that there is no end pin. You have to hold it up with your legs. The fingerboard is shorter. There are gut strings. The bow is convex rather than concave. But beyond those surface features that are, you know, so readily apparent, there's a different way of playing the instrument that I find fascinating.
In relation to the viola da gamba, which had some of the many same physical features as people would see it today, was the cello, even this early cello, replacing? What was its relationship in, let's say, Italy and Germany before we come into France, where the viola da gamba was revered and much music written for it by French composers? But to sort of give us that relationship.
Well, the violin family in general, you know, of course, the cello being part of the violin family, when it first appeared in Renaissance Italy, was not the sort of esteemed family of instruments that we know today. You know, today playing the violin, it's like, oh, yeah. Play the violin, wonderful. And, you know, but the violin and, of course, the cello by extension, at that time, they were sort of rough instruments, you know, the kind of rough and ready instruments. You played them for dancing. You played them wandering around the town. Strangely enough, we have, you know, documentation that cellists, very early cellists, wore the cello on a strap around their neck, and they marched around town with the violin band playing kind of, you know, unrefined music, right, shall we say. Whereas the viol, which had been around for even longer, the viol is a very refined instrument in the minds of most people at that same time. The viol is something that, you know, people who are cultured, people who are from the upper crust of society, shall we say, something that they would play for leisure. And I think that why the violin family, you know, eventually comes to supplant the viol as the preferred instrument in both Italy and then later in Germany, you know, we're seeing that things happen later, of course, elsewhere in Europe, is because the violin family, it's louder, and people were writing this music for it that just had such flash and fire and passion, fireworks. And it was very exciting. And, you know, the violins, of course, for us have been, you know, violin family has been around for a long time now. Basically, we're used to it.
Right.
But at one time, it was new and it was exciting. And people sort of went wild for it the way we would go wild for a new trend today in popular music or in fashion. And they're just like, ah, you know, the viol, oh, we don't need it anymore.
Well, and also, I mean, one thinks that the great string makers, especially violin makers, were flourishing in Italy. You know, Stradivarius and Amati and all these people. And also that there had been music written for the cello coming from Italy, just from well-known names. Vivaldi had written concertos for the cello, as did many other composers. And we should say, you're going to take us to 1730s France with this recording, but 15 years, give or take, we're not really sure, earlier, Bach had written his suites for solo cello. So, I mean, there was this very prestigious, prominent music for the cello. Your recording now gives us a whole, a gaggle of French composers here who are not very well known, even with the explosion of Baroque music over the last 30, 40 years, the period instrument movement. And we've got, you know, I guess you'll start talking about him, Salvatore Lanzetti in Italian, Martin Berthaud, François Martin, and then Jean-Baptiste Barrière. He's the best known. So now, okay, we're here. We're now in France. There's a recital that's going to take place as part of the Concert Spirituel in 1736, I believe.
Yes.
Why did this shock those in attendance? Because it had to do completely with the cello.
To understand why it was so shocking, I think that you have to look at France and its relative isolation, culturally speaking, within Europe. And this has everything to do with the reign of Louis XIV, who reigned far longer than many of his contemporaries. Mm-hmm. And under Louis XIV, he made a real effort to consolidate and codify what it meant to be French in terms of art and language and literature and music. This was a monarch who would issue patents, issued one to Lully and said, okay, you and you alone may write opera.
Right.
Nobody else can do it. And that's something that's not happening elsewhere in Europe. And there's this real resistance to foreign influence. So when Louis dies, all of a sudden, foreign influence starts to creep into France. Before this concert in 1736 at the Concert Spirituel, Vivaldi has very suddenly become the rage. And Couperin, François Couperin, remarks that, you know, in France and Paris, all of a sudden there's this real excitement for what he calls foreign novelties above all else. I don't think he was terribly happy about it as a French composer. But still, even with this foreign influence, the French love the viola da gamba. Everybody else at this point has really kind of said, all right, you know, maybe we'll still use the gamba for a little bit of church music or for a stray piece here or there. But basically, cello is where it's at.
Right.
Violin family, we're sold on it. And the French, by contrast, are still writing some of their most challenging and dazzlingly virtuosic works for the viol. To give it a little bit of perspective, I think it's 1747, somebody will correct me if I'm wrong, that Fourcroy's final book of works for viol are published.
Yeah.
And they're published posthumously, but the fact that they're published at all says that there's still a great, you know, excitement for the viol. So in 1736, Lanzetti comes and he performs on the series of concerts that we, you know, are known as the Concert Spirituel. And for us as, you know, modern listeners, modern performers, it's like, okay, well, big deal. Cellist plays a recital. We've seen that song and dance before. But he's the first cellist, the first solo cellist to play at the Concert Spirituel. And this is just, you know, absolutely crazy all on its own. Because to the French, the cello is not a solo instrument. The cello is an instrument that accompanies. It's not, you know, something lovely and refined, and it doesn't deserve to be center stage at, you know, this concert series.
Hence the title of your CD, Enter the Devil. They were quite derogatory, or some of the critic or the movers and shakers are really derogatory towards this instrument, like you said, comparing it to just a street musician type of thing, right? I mean, there was no dignity to the cello at this point.
Exactly. Like, historically, if you go back and you look at, you know, French dictionaries that are talking about the cello, or, you know, other French writers, people who are writing about the cello, and the cello is not a nice instrument in their eyes. It is rough and it is rustic. You use it to accompany dance music, but that's about it. And for some people, this idea that the cello would become a solo instrument was really distasteful, and I took the title of the album from a treatise or a little book that I discovered for myself called The Defense of the Bass Viol Against the Pretensions of the Cello. I found it when I was working on my thesis at Oberlin, and I thought, well, that sounds interesting. And luckily I speak French, and the school has an actual copy of it, and it's a really neat little thing. I mean, it's actually, like, quite small. It's no bigger than the palm of my hand, or rather my hands, you know, palm and fingers together. And in it, this jurist, you know, sort of a lawyer, is talking about how the devil cello will never triumph over Lady Viol. And I thought, well, if he was so upset, I bet a lot of other people were upset too. And when you start getting into the repertoire, and it's so experimental. It's really crazy. Some of the things that they do, I've heard colleagues write it off. They're like, oh, they didn't mean that. That's not playable. I thought, oh, who's going to waste paper and ink publishing something that's not playable?
Right.
It's really crazy stuff. It's like all of a sudden they said, hey, we can play the cello as a solo instrument. Let's see just exactly what this thing can do.
Yeah, I want to get to that experimental nature of some of the things that from some of the composers represented in this disc. So this concert, this recital takes place with Lanzetti, who played his own music that was not out of the ordinary back then, especially as a traveling virtuoso. But the aftermath, the result, was not what most of cultured, established, safe musical French establishment wanted, because it kind of lit a fuse. I mean, well, you can tell the story. Yeah, go ahead. So the aftermath of all this.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, on the one hand, you had people who were really upset that there had been this recital. And actually, he played two recitals, so they were probably doubly upset that Lanzetti, you know, this Italian, had been there and playing this, you know, music that was absolutely not French. But then there's a sort of equal portion of persons, particularly what I call cellist composers, people who both played and wrote for the instrument, who were very clearly inspired to a degree that I have never really encountered in any other repertory. They went nuts. They really went kind of nuts. There's one piece in particular that I love to mention where I have to play with my chin.
Yeah.
And you're looking at the indication, you're going, "You're not serious. Like, come on, this is not serious. This is something you do in like 20th and 21st century music. This is something you do in the 18th century. But there's no other way to hit the notes." I was like, okay, I guess we're going to do this. And, it ended up being a lot more difficult than I thought it was going to be. It hurt a lot more than I thought it would.
You should probably help that visual of our listeners. So the chin is actually placed on the fingerboard as you would a finger, right, to hold
it
down
is.
A string. And then they bowed under the strings, or bowed backwards, I should say, right?
Right, underhanded bowing.
Underhanded bowing.
Yes, like you would on a viola da gamba, because here you are in France, and you've got all of these viol players, and suddenly the cello is trendy, you know, and people want to hear cello music. And it's like, well, you know, there are a lot of similarities sort of visually between the cello and the viol, even though, you know, they're actually, as we say, organologically, the fancy word, unrelated. It means they're from different families of instruments. So they're actually constructed quite differently. But they look similar. And cellists often play viol because we already know how to hold the instrument.
Right.
So it's kind of an easy switch for us. So all these viol players who are then saying, okay, well, I see which way the wind's blowing. I'm going to play cello. And why change the way that you're bowing? If you can already bow, you know, underhanded, why would you switch to overhand? And so Martin Berthaud, there is, you know, a tradition that's been passed down orally and recorded in various books that he himself did this same thing. And there's a really wonderful, you know, Opus 1 collection of sonatas by him that are just so charming and so cheeky is the best word I can think of. And when I decided, okay, I'm going to do this, I'm going to play his works, I thought, well, I'll play underhanded as well and see what it sounds like. And it was a very humbling experience for me.
You didn't like how it sounded like originally.
Oh, I hated it. I really hated it. I was like, oh, what was I thinking? You know, you approach it and you're so confident. Like, yeah, I got this. And then, you know, start playing. It's like, oh, no. Oh, what did I get myself into? And so I went back and forth for weeks about how was I going to play it, and finally had this epiphany where I realized that I was falling into the classic trap for historical performers, which was that I was assuming that I knew what it was supposed to sound like, and that I was assuming that I, in the 21st century, knew what a good sound was. And, well, I would like to, you know, don't want to pat myself on the back too much, but I'd like to say I think I do know what a good sound is, but I was not allowing for the fact that in the 18th century, they might have had a very different concept of what constituted a beautiful sound. And once I sort of got myself out of that, you know, particular corner, you know, beating my head against the wall, things really took off. And it became, I think, something really special.
Thank you. So here's the opening movement from Martin Berthaud's Cello Sonata in G Major, Opus 1, Number 3, the so-called chin music, as it asks the cellist, in this case my guest today, Juliana Soltis, to use the chin to make some notes sound on the instrument. The final two works in the disc are by Jean-Baptiste Barrière. That's how he says his name, right? Barrière. He really sort of moved it to the next level. He produced a number of pieces, a number of sonatas, books of sonatas for the cello. Again, in a very experimental mode in some of them, but he sort of took the next steps from where we began the CD in 1736 with Lanzetti's recital, correct?
Oh, absolutely. I think what's really interesting about Barrière as a composer is that he writes four books of sonatas, and the first two seem very French. They have a lot of the same characteristics as the Berthaud and as the Martin. So he's writing, you know, kind of Italian-esque music, but in a French style. And he then leaves Paris, and he actually goes to Italy for a while to study. And when he comes back, he publishes two more books of sonatas, and they are stylistically so different from the first two books that you would almost think it was a different composer if you didn't know better and if you weren't looking at the title page. And so you see, and what I wanted to create with the disc was this sense of a journey from when Lanzetti first plays in Paris and then this explosion of creativity among the French cellist composers, and then finally arriving at Barrière is kind of a culmination of this particular movement, who then goes to Italy and really learns how to do things in Lanzetti's own kind of style, in the Italian style, and comes back, brings it to France, and it's like the metamorphosis is complete.
Right. And we should say on this disc, you're accompanied by continuo instruments, harpsichord, terbo, but also viola da gamba. I mean, things didn't change overnight.
And, oh, absolutely not.
Right. From Book One of Jean-Baptiste Barrière's Sonatas for Cello, this the number 4 in D major, the movement titled Aria Amoroso, performed by my guest today, Juliana Soltis. I think what you said before is very important as far as how you approach this. And, you know, I mentioned at the outset how last week we had Mario Roberts, who's doing new music on cello, extending sound worlds and doing different techniques, extended techniques on cello. And what our listeners just heard is said, this is not a new 21st century, late 20th century avant-gardist realm. You had these composers back then confronted with, for some of them, a new instrument. And they tried out all kinds of things. I'm just curious if you can sort of put that idea into period instrument performance, trying to recreate as best we can what happened. And like you said, there's kind of a leap of faith there because you have to leave your 21st century notion of what sounds correct. You have to leave it aside. So talk about that. It's a very interesting approach you have. So,
well, I think that there is a sort of fallacy in any age, and it's kind of Candide-esque, that assumes that ours is the best possible way of doing things and that we're reinventing the wheel every day. And that's not to say that there aren't amazing and exciting things going on now in music, but I think it's important to remember, and it can be difficult for both performer and audience because we are so far removed chronologically from the music that we're playing and listening to, that at one time, Mozart was brand new.
Right.
At one time, Vivaldi's brand new. All these familiar composers, at one time, what they were doing was as fresh as just, you know, turning on the radio to like your top 40 station and hearing, you know, the latest single that has come out. And for me as a performer, what's exciting is helping listeners to bridge that gap and breathing some kind of like life, some flesh and blood back into not just the composers and the performers, but the works that were written, you know, centuries ago.
But it is the idea that the period instrument, the Renaissance of looking at music from the Renaissance Baroque periods and from these centuries back, has been going on now for almost 50 years robustly. But I think the idea that is you can't use your modern sensibility, you've got to try at least to accept the fact that what they heard may not have sounded to our ears, for lack of a better word, pleasant or acceptable, and that's the way it was. I mean, you know, there's a sense of experiment, of research there, and I assume you're going to continue to do that.
But absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, where do you take it from here after this first disco? Where do you take not only what you're doing, but your research, and where do you go from here? So,
what really guides me and motivates me as a performer and as a scholar is to find the moments that have been forgotten. There is, in any history, so much more than what ends up in the textbooks. And it's those composers, those pieces, those moments that have sort of gotten brushed off into the margins that I find so exciting because it gives us a richer sense of our own musical heritage. I know that there may be people who will listen to the album and write it off and say, these aren't important composers.
Right.
And while it's true, it's not Lully, it's not Mozart, they nevertheless existed and they contributed to the musical world in which these other composers lived. And I would hope that in exploring lesser-known works and kind of, you know, digging into the dusty corners of the library, that not only do we unearth, you know, new old music
right.
for people to play, but then it makes those composers who we, you know, revere as being so singular and special in music history, that it makes them shine even brighter, because suddenly they have context. So for me, I'm going to keep going, you know, my own way, not only, you know, looking for things that maybe haven't been played or for a moment that has been forgotten, but also I'm hoping in future discs to maybe revisit some of the composers who are a little more familiar, like Bach or Beethoven,
mm-hmm.
and shining a light there to say, is there something that we've missed? You know, is there something that then contributes that much more to our understanding of the music, to our enjoyment of the music? Is there some way that I can help people who are listening to it connect with the music in a much more fulfilling way?
Back to Jean-Baptiste Barrier, but hear from his book 3 of cello sonatas after his trip to Italy, where the cello was long established. This is the second movement, Corrente Allegro, performed by my guest today on her debut recording called Entre le Diable, Juliana Soltis. Thank you. Well, I congratulate you on this disc, and it's going to be great to hear what you continue to do. I have to ask you, over the 12 years, 12 plus years, it'll be 13 November that Cadenza's been on, I've had many great cellists on this program, and they never escape that I have to ask them this. You just mentioned his name. He's a contributor with a capital C. Bach did leave cellists gold. He left them these six suites, which are only yours. They could be transcribed and played by other instruments, but they are for the cello. And those suites, you know, you've performed them. I think you even performed them in Japan, if I read right.
I did.
Those suites mean something different to every cellist. How you use them, how they're part of your life, what they mean to you. So I was wondering, what do they mean to you? What do the Bach suites mean to you, and how do you use them in your life?
Bach definitely has a very special place in my life, as it does, I think, for all cellists.
Sure.
But Bach was the first thing I ever actually went to my teacher, and I said, I want to play this. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know who Bach was. Terrible. I was 11 years old, and I had heard the prelude from the first suite, and I had figured out how to play, like, you know, from ear the first, you know, few bars of it, and I played it for my teacher, and I was like, I want to play this. She kind of looks at me, you know, and she's like, oh, please, I want to play this. I promise I'll practice. And she gave me the minuets from the first suite, and that's how it started for me. But I think what makes Bach so special and so important in my life is that he is the constant companion. In my own career, I have, you know, gone from being an orchestral musician to playing contemporary music and to finally, you know, wending my way to early music and historical performance. But I've always played Bach in any number of styles, and I've played the suites multiple times. And it's uncanny how he, among all composers, you can keep coming back to over and over again and always find something that you missed before, or that I can open up, you know, the music and look at what I did last time. I wrote my bowings and go, oh God, why did I do that? It doesn't go that way. And, you know, so Bach is special to me because he's a companion for life. As long as I can play the cello, I'm going to be playing Bach.
Yeah, it's fascinating to get all the different cellists' answers of what these pieces mean to them. Well, again, we wish you continued success. Get more recordings out, and hope to hear you in concert. I know you're playing with Gotham Early Music Scene New York every once in a while. We broadcast them every month, so we'll probably hear you on our airwaves. I close all my Cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two quick questions. And the first is a hypothetical, which says, if you could chat like we've been chatting with someone from the past, someone you never had a chance to speak to but could pick their brain. When I asked that, what was the first name that came into your head? If you think about it too long, you get swamped. But
Yeah.
What was the first name that popped in your head about somebody you could chat with if you had a chance to?
Oh, you know, honestly, the first name that popped into my head was Bach.
Yeah.
Because I am getting the suites ready again, and I'm actually working on all six at the same time this time. And I will admit it, I still get intensely frustrated sometimes looking at all the different sources, and I would love to just be able to ask him, one, was there a fair copy, and where did you hide it?
Yeah.
And two, you know, to say, here, what were you thinking here?
It's fascinating with Bach because, you know, we think that he wrote them because he had two great players at that court in Curtin. And obviously he didn't, I mean, the violin concertos, I've had great world-class violinists say Bach wrote the best violin music, and he did dabble on the violin. But, you know, I would think if you'd talk to Bach, you'd also sort of press his arm and say, where's the cello concerto, you know?
Oh, I know. I'd love to say that to Beethoven, too. Oh,
yeah.
No, not Beethoven. Romberg. I'd like to go to Romberg, who Beethoven offered to write a concerto for. And he's like, oh, no, that's okay. I do my own stuff. And when I read that in a history book, it was like, really? Man, I have no Beethoven concerto because of you. Thanks a lot.
Take that back. The final question is non-musical, meaning everybody I interview in Cadenza fills their life with music. You're very busy just preparing the suites again. But when you have to do something that is non-musical, take yourself away from music, a little respite, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, what do you do when you need to pull away for a few minutes?
Oh, my gosh, yeah, when I actually have, like, a moment to myself. I got a dog last year. I adopted an ex-racing greyhound, a retired racing greyhound. So now, you know, when I'm not on the road and I come home to Seattle, my favorite thing to do, honestly, is to just curl up on the couch with the dog and we binge watch TV shows together. not terribly exciting.
He's given up his restless life, I guess.
He has. Yeah. He is a committed, 45-mile-an-hour couch potato now. So.
Well, I hope you get some time to do that. Well, again, continued success. And Juliana Soltis, thanks for taking some time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Cellist Juliana Soltis. You can find out more about her at her website, Juliana Soltis, SOLTIS.com. Her debut CD is on the Ossies label, from which we have heard throughout this program. Finds her accompanied on that disc by Adaya McAdams-Sommer on viola da gamba, Lucas Harris on tierbo, and Justin Murphy Mancini on harpsichord, and it is called Entre le Diable, Enter the Devil, the virtuoso cello at the Concert Spirituel. You can check it out at the label's website, Ossies, A-C-I-S, OssiesProductions.com. And I'll leave you with, yes, more music from that disc. Earlier, we heard the first movement from Martin Berthaud's Cello Sonata in G Major, Opus 1, Number 3, asking the cellist to use his or her chin to finger some notes. But these French composers with this quote-unquote new instrument to them experimented with many sounds that must have mesmerized their audiences. I'll leave you with the final two movements from that sonata, the Allegro and Rondo Amoroso, performed by my guest today, cellist Juliana Soltis. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you. And thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org. Thank you.